Dad taught me a simple lesson. When the alarm clock goes off, you get out of bed, you have a shave, you wash yourself, put your clothes on, and go to work. You got to be resilient, and you got to be focused on what you want to achieve. My father believed the measure of a person was whether or not they were a worker. He believed that working was a virtue. So do I. Work has always been essential to human survival and part of the natural order. In the societies my ancestors lived in, it was a given that people would get up every morning, work hard, and provide for their families. Days were spent hunting, fishing, and gathering food, building shelter and tools, and burning bush and vegetation to make their land productive, better for food sources. If you don't work, you die. The nature of work has changed and it will keep changing. Modern economies rely on machines, computers, foreign trade and large-scale farming, manufacturing and production. People no longer hunt their own food or build their own shelters, and most people can't. People do other kinds of work to earn income they use to buy what they need from others. All over the world, improved technology has radically changed the way humans live, leading to greater urbanisation. In Britain, there was a great exodus of people from rural areas to cities in the 18th and 19th centuries, seeking work in the factories, mills and metalworks created by the Industrial Revolution. British towns grew fast and infrastructures and services lagged behind, with poor sanitation, filthy streets and overcrowded housing. Horror stories of the workhouses and industrial workplaces are etched in the Western imagination through tales of writers like Charles Dickens. In truth, the rural lives people left behind were at least, if not more, impoverished. Human life before the dawn of modern technology was extremely bleak. In pre-industrial societies, most people lived their short lives in a subsistent lifestyle in abject poverty. They also worked long hours in harsh conditions, mostly in seasonal agriculture. Britain experienced multiple famines and plague epidemics, wiped out large proportions of the population. People flocked to new industrial workplaces for their survival and because they aspired for better lives. And human life did improve. Death rates dropped and life expectancy rose. Despite the increased populations this created, wages rose over time, and food supplies and diets improved. Famine and plague came to an end, average working hours shrunk, and the cost of goods substantially decreased. The technological leaps since the early 1700s, including from machines, medical science and sanitation, have delivered extraordinary gains globally in human prosperity and quality of life. And somewhere along the way during this amazing transformation, many of the intellectual classes in the West stopped believing in work as essential to survival, beneficial, a source of pride, a virtue. They come to characterise work as a negative. I pinpoint the origins of this mindset to 19th century political philosopher Karl Marx, who saw a working class exploited by business owners. To Marx, the source of exploitation wasn't so much the conditions of 19th century factories, but the act of a business owner making a profit. He saw the difference between what workers were paid for their labour and what the business owner earned from the production of that labour as a surplus wrongly taken from workers. Marx saw a world of finite resources which business owners and workers would increasingly battle over until the system eventually collapsed in on itself, leading to communist utopia. It didn't. Technology increased resources, reduced need, and made people better off. Actually, it was those states founded on Marxist ideology that experienced economic collapse. But even a Marxist economist come and went, the idea of work as a form of exploitation has stuck and taken on a life of its own. Strictly, it was the profit-taking, not the work, which Marx saw as exploitation. He actually wrote about labour as fundamental to a person's being, as having almost spiritual significance. When I condemn the socialist left for their attitudes to work and welfare, I occasionally get comments on social media from genuine Marxists. There are still some around who believe Marx would be equally appalled by these attitudes. We'll never know. What I do know is that increasingly we hear the idea there's something wrong with wanting people to work, particularly in debates and discussions about welfare reform, where we regularly hear why welfare recipients shouldn't be expected or even can't work. We hear that requiring people to do work or activities in return for welfare is exploitation and wrong, that moving people from welfare to work is unfair because they become part of the working poor, that some jobs like seasonal fruit picking or labouring, or even work someone is overqualified for, are just not good enough to expect people to go off welfare, that there aren't enough jobs for unemployed people to do, that employers discriminate against older and disabled workers, so there's no point them trying. When I first heard the expression working poor, I had to ask for an explanation. Even then I didn't understand. People on welfare are already live in poverty. So those who warn that welfare to work will create a working poor are really saying being poor is undignified enough. It's an added indignity to be poor and working. This is a terrible outlook. My family was part of the working poor my entire childhood. Working wasn't an indignity, it was a source of pride. Mum and Dad moved our family to Sydney for greater opportunities, where Dad was able to earn more money. They had the dignity of being self-sufficient and able to aspire for more. I chose to be part of the working poor over the welfare poor any day. I chose a three-month fruit-picking job over 3 months on the dole without a second thought. It wouldn't matter to me if the job wasn't permanent or long-term, or if it is paid less than I earned in the past. In fact, in my life, I have taken jobs on lower pay with fewer opportunities or hours because they were the only options. A job is a job. Being in a job, any job, makes the next job opportunity, a permanent job, a higher paid job, a better job, much more likely. Even outside of the welfare reform debate, we hear anti-work rhetoric. We hear it's unfair of some people earn. We hear it is unfair if some people earn less than others, even if they're less experienced, qualified or capable. Listen out for this mantra in debates over whether teachers in government schools should be paid on merit, or whether it's right to pay teenagers lower wages so employers have more incentive to hire them. The latest anti-work political idea is that governments should pay everyone a non-means-tested universal basic income with no obligation to work. The Greens recently made this their policy because they say in the future everyone being in full-time work will never be possible or desirable. So the overarching message from influential sections of the intellectual class is that work is exploitive, an indignity, a burden, that work enforces inequality, it's scarce and even dangerous. At least that is for the downtrodden, the poor, the unskilled, those on welfare, the young, the aged and the disabled, and in the future, most unskilled workers. If ever there was a bad idea that needed a stake driven through its heart, it's this one. The mindset of work as something negative is allowing many families and communities to be destroyed. The welfare safety net, where the state provides a guaranteed stipend to those who can't support themselves, was one of the most significant public policy innovations of the 20th century Western world. In the tribal societies of my ancestors, people pooled their resources in large family groups. Those who could contribute had roles and responsibility in caring for those who couldn't, like the young and the aged. Aboriginal kinship structures acted as a natural welfare system. If someone you were responsible for in the kinship structure needed or asked for help, the law required you to help them. These communities were small, actually large families, and everyone knew everyone else. So you also knew if someone was meeting their responsibilities, and they knew if you were truly unable to contribute. Most human societies began in a similar way, with small familial groups and close subsistence living and mutual kinship obligations. Modernisation and urbanisation saw these ancient structures change, often disappearing entirely. Congregated in large cities with people from many and disparate regions and origins, people couldn't necessarily rely on kin to care for and protect them. We're often reliant entirely on the churches and the charity of others to survive. The current welfare system in Australia was introduced progressively, mostly after the Second World War. Today it comprises around 20 income support payments and 55 supplementary payments and is very complex. Income support payments fall into two categories: the age pension and payments to working age people who are either unemployed or not expected to work for a particular reason. Supplementary payments include things like rent assistance and family benefits. There are two parallel campaigns for welfare reform in Australia going on at the moment. One is a push for reforms to simplify the system, improve incentives to work, and reform the mechanisms for dealing with breaches to drive the right behaviours. The coalition government is driving these reforms. It has struggled to get major reforms through the Senate, but did pass some material reforms in the early 2018.